Our reading today is from Psalm 44, which is on page 568 of the Church Bibles. Now, to give you just a little bit of context, that Psalm 44 itself is actually a national lament psalm, but the verses we're focusing on explicitly today are verses 1 through 8. And they hearken back to the period in Israel's history that we've been studying, looking through Joshua, and speaks of the great deeds that God has done in Israel's past and how their very existence is a direct consequence of God's actions and his participation in the history of his people. It is nothing short of a faithful record of the infinite mercy of God and the many ways by which he has testified his fatherly love to his people. So Psalm 44. We have heard with our ears, O God. Our fathers have told us what you did in their days and days long ago. With your hand you drove out the nations and planted our fathers. You crushed the peoples and made our fathers flourish. It was not by their sword that they won the land, nor did their arm bring them victory. It was your right hand, your arm, and the light of your face, for you loved them. You are my king and my God, who decrees victory for Jacob. Through you we push back our enemies. Through your name we trample our foes. I do not trust in my bow. My sword does not bring me victory, but you give us victory over our enemies. You put our adversaries to shame. In God we make our boast all day long, and we will praise your name forever.
Thank you very much, Matt. I think we've got a map, yes. I thought it'd be useful to have this in front of you as we talk about the conquest of the land. And it shows you where the different tribes went and this important dividing line from the Jordan River with the three tribes on the east, Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and then the tribes on the west, the rest of the tribe of Manasseh and the other tribes. And it just puts it into context a little bit. Well, looking at the service sheet, someone has already taken fright and said, do I mind if they leave at 12 o'clock? And the answer is not in the least. And if we do run a little bit over, which I hope we won't, do feel no embarrassment, just leave. It is a big chunk we're looking at today, so fasten your seatbelts. Basically, what I want to do is to review these chapters briefly, but on the way, look more closely at one or two aspects that I think have some important lessons for Christians and churches in the 21st century. However, before doing that, I want to go back to something that Chris dealt with briefly last week, and we were chatting about it subsequently, and agreeing that I would pick it up again because of its importance and because it is an acute problem for some people, and it's raised particularly in the book of Joshua. Last week, Chris quoted from Richard Dawkins, who, among other unpleasant things, said that the God of the Old Testament was a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser. And I want to say a bit more about this because, although most people wouldn't take such an extreme view, the whole issue of the ruthlessness of the taking over of Canaan does disturb quite a lot of people. Now, in the book of Deuteronomy, in chapter 7, Moses was preparing the people for the invasion of the promised land. And he said this to them, Deuteronomy 7, verse 1. When the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, which he lists, and when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and you've defeated them, then you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them and show no mercy. And Joshua did that. We read in chapter 6, verse 21, after the destruction of Jericho, they devoted the city to the Lord and destroyed with the sword every living thing in it. Men and women, young and old, cattle, sheep, and donkeys. How could a good God command such ruthless behavior? Well, in the passage that we read from Deuteronomy, Moses goes on to say this, verse 3, chapter 7. Do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods, and the Lord's anger will burn against you and will quickly destroy you. What was this terrible risk if they intermarried? Now, obviously, if the people remained in the land, boy would meet girl, and inevitably there would be marriages between the Israelites and the Canaanites. That was a realistic assumption by Moses. But what was it that they were really risking? Well, we're so anxious nowadays to be politically correct and to sound terribly tolerant and to be very academic about other religions that we can fail to see the true nature of pagan religion. Well, in due course, what Moses had feared happened, and Israel began to get corrupted. And in the second book of Kings, which was many years later, we read this. In the 17th year of Pekah, son of Remaliah, Ahaz, son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. Unlike David, his father, he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord his God. He walked in the ways of the kings of Israel and even sacrificed his son in the fire, following the detestable ways of the nations the Lord had driven out before the Israelites. That's what the Lord was seeking to protect the Israelites from. Child sacrifice. And many other dreadful things that went on, sexually and in other ways, in the religion of Canaan. I googled child sacrifice last week to see what it said, and it's pretty shocking. It's gone on all over the world, not just in Canaan, and God does not like that. He doesn't like little children being burned alive. He doesn't think it's a good idea, so he wanted to suppress it. He wanted to wipe out all memory of it, all the excuses for it, all the aspects of Baal worship, which inevitably brought it in. He wanted all these influences wiped out. Now, there's much more that could be said about this. I simply wanted to indicate the broad fact that sometimes the goodness and love of God demands the suppression of evil. But it's interesting to note that this theme of ruthlessness with evil continues in the New Testament in the context of our spiritual warfare with sin. Under the New Covenant, under the New Testament, there's no question, of course, of us killing other people because we don't think they're right. But there is a real ruthlessness which there ought to be in dealing with our own sin. Think about these very sobering words of Jesus, Matthew chapter 5. If your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Of course, Jesus was speaking figuratively. He wasn't speaking literally. He was speaking in this dramatic way to get us to be serious about turning away from sin. And we're not naturally serious. You know, you can hear people say, oh, well, I know I've always been a bit bad-tempered, but that's just me. And that attitude is entirely wrong for a Christian. A Christian should be seeking, with the help of the Spirit of God, to improving his temper as time goes on. This message was repeated by the Apostle Paul. I haven't time to go into all the references. He speaks about it in Romans, and then in Colossians chapter 3 he says this, put to death. Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, and then in case we think we're not guilty of any of that, evil desires and greed, which is idolatry. And the message is that we need to take our sin seriously and do something about it. We can seek forgiveness for it, but the teaching of Jesus and the teaching of the apostles was that we must also seek to be changed. Now, I could say a lot more about the Canaanites and about this subject, but I hope that I've given enough headlines for us just to see that there's no necessary conflict between the love of God and the severity of God, his desire to wipe out evil because it hurts us so much. Now, what about the conquest? Well, last week, you remember, we heard about the Gibeonites, who were fly enough to manage to fool the Israelites into a treaty which protected them. And Chris went into all the background to that. And then the battle that defeated the five kings of the Amorites, Joshua 9 and 10. And in chapter 11, we get on to the defeat of the northern kings. They're in the northern part of Canaan at a place called the Waters of Merom. And then the chapter goes on, and at the end it says this, so Joshua took the entire land, just as the Lord had directed Moses, and he gave it as an inheritance to Israel, according to their tribal divisions. That is looking forward. That's a summary of what was going to happen. And in 12:1-6, it begins by discussing the defeat of Sihon, king of the Amorites, and Og, the king of Bashan, by Moses on the east side of Jordan, before Joshua took over and they went into the promised land. And then it gives a list of 31 kings that Joshua went on to defeat. And then in chapter 13, the Lord speaks to Joshua. And he doesn't mince his words. He doesn't say, well, you're amazing for your age or anything like that. Verse 1, it just says, you are very old. You are very old. And then he goes on to say that the rest of the land remains to be taken over. But he finishes with a special promise of help. Verse 6, I myself will drive them out before the Israelites. And then in the rest of the chapter, we have the land east of the Jordan, where the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh lived, and their divisions are listed. In chapter 14, we've got a brief explanation about the division of the land west of the Jordan and a special note about Caleb, who had been one of the spies with Joshua 40 years before, who had spied out Canaan. And he was another tough pensioner, because he says this, he's 85, and I am still as strong today as the day Moses sent me out. Lucky man. Lucky man. I certainly don't feel as strong as I was 40 years ago. Chapter 15 is a bit more about Caleb and the allocation of the land to all the different family groups in Judah. And then we get a bit of a downer. Because in the last verse, verse 63, we read this. Judah could not dislodge the Jebusites who were living in Jerusalem. Could not. Or would not trust God to give them the victory. Chapter 16, the allotment for the family groups of Ephraim and a bit of Manasseh on the west side of the Jordan. But again, verse 10, bit of a sad note. They did not dislodge the Canaanites living in Gezer. To this day, the Canaanites live among the people of Ephraim, but are required to do forced labor. I wonder what the thinking was behind that. Hey guys, let's not wipe these people out. They can be slaves. We can party while they're doing the hard work. And it would all sound so appealing. But the people of Ephraim made a terrible mistake in doing that. And then in chapter 17, there's the detailed allotment. Manasseh was such a big tribe that the family groups, the clans as they call it, which always sounds terribly Scottish to me, the detailed allotment for the clans is given, and the other half of the tribe that went over the Jordan with the rest of the Israelites is all mapped out. And sadly, for the third time, verses 12 and 13, yet the Manassites were not able to occupy these towns, for the Canaanites were determined to live in that region. However, when the Israelites grew stronger, they subjected the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not drive them out completely. Now, if you want to know what the results of these failures were, read Judges, Samuel, Kings, Chronicles, and all that went on there, because they hadn't driven out all the Canaanites. But on top of that failure, they weren't content with their allocation of land, and they demanded more space and told Joshua they'd got to have some extra land. And so he said, okay, expand into the forested area in the plain occupied by the Perizzites and Rephaites. But they complained that these tribes had advanced military technology. Verse 16, the Canaanites who live in the plain have iron chariots, Joshua. How do you think we can cope with that? Well, Joshua wasn't having any of it. He said, you are numerous and very powerful, and though they are strong, you can drive them out. And chapter 18 establishes the allocation to the remaining seven tribes. And the part of verse 1 notes that the country was brought under their control. They'd occupied the country. But in verse 3, Joshua says to the Israelites, how long will you wait before you begin to take possession of the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you? They were an occupying army, but they hadn't colonized the territory. They didn't really possess it. They hadn't settled down in it. But before they could do that, there had to be some organization. Verse 4. Appoint 3 men from each tribe. That's a total of 21 men. I will send them out to make a survey of the land and to write a description of it according to the inheritance of each. Then they will return to me. You're to divide the land into 7 parts. Judah is to remain in its territory on the south, and the house of Joseph in its territory on the north. And after you have written descriptions, the 7 parts of the land, bring them here to me, and I will cast lots for you in the presence of the Lord our God. I think what hard work that was. These guys had no theodolites. They had no sat-nav. They had no aerial photographs. They just had to slog their way over the territory day by day, on foot, counting paces, describing features of the land which could be used as markers for dividing it up into 7 territories. How important it is, so often in God's work, to get organized. Think of the New Testament. Think of last week in All Age Worship, when we thought about the miracle that was referred to today of Jesus feeding thousands on 5 loaves and 2 fishes. How did he start? Mark 6, verse 39, Jesus directed them, that is his disciples, to have all the people sit down in groups on the green grass, so they sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties. In other words, he was saying to his disciples, get things organized. I'm not going to work with people milling around where we don't know who's been fed and who hasn't and who's had too much and who's had nothing and so on. And he did a great miracle because the people were organized. I wonder how often we notice the appointment of God in 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 28, where it lists the people God has appointed in the church. And in the church of God, it says, he has appointed, first of all, apostles. And then it goes on through the various appointments. And then it says, those with gifts of administration. A church which is serious about its work and witness for the Lord is going to be properly administered. I say that with a little bit of edge because we've had an awful lot of administration to do with the new trust deed, happily accepted, and the new governance document and all these other things. But they do matter. So let's value those who have a gift for this and see that we don't hinder the work of the Lord by disorganization. No one's going to be brought to faith by organization. But a lack of it can often hinder people from being brought to faith. And then at the end of the chapter, the tribe of Benjamin gets their allotment, and it goes on into chapter 19, the rest of the tribes, and Joshua himself. And he gets a town in the hill country of Ephraim. Then in chapter 20 is the cities of refuge. There's not time to go into the significance of them, but just briefly, there were places you could go if you had accidentally and innocently killed someone else and were being pursued by people who wanted to take vengeance on you. Chapter 21 was the Levites. They didn't have any land in the sense of inheritance because God was their inheritance, but of course they had to live somewhere, so they were given 48 towns in which to live. And all this process of conquest, settlement, all that went on was evidence of the faithfulness of God, just as the psalm recalled. Verse 43 of the chapter. So the Lord gave Israel all the land he had sworn to give their forefathers, and they took possession of it and settled there. The Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their forefathers. Not one of their enemies withstood them. The Lord handed all their enemies over to them. Not one word of the Lord's good promises to the house of Israel failed. Every one was fulfilled. End of story? Not quite, because you see, we're dealing with human beings here. And chapter 22 tells us how things nearly went completely pear-shaped. It starts terribly well, because Moses had made an agreement with the three tribes on the eastern side, that although they were settling there, they were to send their soldiers over into the west to help their brothers to conquer the rest of the land. And they'd done that. And then we read in chapter 22 that Joshua summoned the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh and said to them, "You have done all that the servant of the Lord commanded. You have obeyed me in everything I commanded. For a long time now, to this very day, you have not deserted your brothers, but have carried out the mission the Lord your God gave you." Would that we could hear words like that to us on the day of judgment. But then the eastern tribes, without saying anything, decide to build a spectacular altar. Verse 10. When they were going back, they came to Geliloth, just before they got to the Jordan, in the land of Canaan. The Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an imposing altar there by the Jordan. And the western tribes, not unnaturally, immediately see it as a rival to the true altar of sacrifice already established at Mount Ebal, see chapter 8, and perhaps also to the tent of meeting established at Shiloh, chapter 18. And this is such a serious threat to the true worship of God, to the whole structure of the revelation of God to them, that only war will sort it out. Verse 11. When the Israelites heard that they had built the altar on the border of Canaan at Geliloth, near the Jordan, on the Israelite side, the whole assembly of Israel gathered at Shiloh to go to war against them. An absolutely classic human situation arising from lack of communication. Lack of communication. And just in time, we read how in verses 21 to 29, the eastern tribes explain to the western tribes that it's not an altar of sacrifice. They were scared that because they were on the east of Jordan, somehow they would be considered inferior or not part of Israel. And so they directed this, particularly for their descendants, as an altar of witness, not an altar of sacrifice. Their faith unified them with the western tribes. And finally, the whole thing simmered down, and they went off in safety. And we today, we need to do that too, don't we? We need to communicate to prevent misunderstandings in church life, in family life, in personal life. It's so easy not to communicate and to let things go misunderstood. So let's close by thinking about the four things that I think we can pull out of these chapters. There's so much, but we've just thought about four. Think about ruthlessness and the need for ruthlessness then and in our own lives. And then these two things that sound so pedestrian, so ordinary, and are so important. Good organization, good communication. And finally, chapter 21 and verse 45, not one of the Lord's good promises to the house of Israel failed. Every one was fulfilled. And we can live in the confidence that God's promises still are and always will be.